Chapter 2. Scientific and Unscientific Methods. What is science? The Encyclopedia Britannica goes on for pages and pages on the subject of philosophy of science, but I am trying to pinpoint only the essential attributes of science. Science starts with observation. To have science, you must first observe the phenomena being studied. This is in contrast to believing what other people tell you is true, even though they might be of priesthood, claiming to know the absolute and ultimate truth, or even though they might be other scientists. Our human perception does not give us an accurate representation of reality. They give us only a gross approximation of reality. They do not show us disease germs. They do not show us the interactions of subatomic entities that manifest themselves as the reality that we perceive. They do not detect all the combined radio and television broadcasts that are in our environment constantly. Given the limitations of human perceptions, science strives for the most accurate observations that can be made with these perceptions, and only for knowledge that can be obtained within these limitations. We have many kinds of instruments, such as microscopes and telescopes and particle accelerators, to extend the reach of those perceptions. We can also extend the reach of our observations with logic and mathematics, by making logical inferences. But in no case does science make any assumption about anything beyond the reach of observation, even though it might be presented on the very highest authority. Scientists don't always even believe other scientists. The second essential ingredient of science is replication. Scientists make their own observations and see if they agree with the observations of other scientists. Only if an observation is replicated many times over does it qualify as a scientific finding. Replication helps to smooth out the errors that might be made in individual observations. The third essential ingredient of science is accurate logic. I use one word logic to mean the human ability to reason and its man-made extensions of formal logic and mathematics. The logic can be and must be 100% correct. For a conclusion to be valid logically, it must follow from the observed conditions and cannot be arrived at in any other way. Thus, scientific experiments are designed to keep everything constant except the one variable to be tested. But science doesn't have to be done in a laboratory. There are field studies as well as laboratory studies. Accurate observation alone by trained observers qualifies as science. For example, hurricanes or animals in their natural environment can't be studied in a laboratory. But when enough observations of these things have been made, the criterion of replication is met, and a body of scientific knowledge can be developed. So, I see three essential ingredients in science: observation, replication, and valid logic, with observation, the first step, being the most important. Science can be observation alone, but to draw conclusions from that observation and call it a scientific finding, scientific determination, or even scientific opinion, it must have all three ingredients. I prefer to use the plural scientific methods rather than the singular scientific method, because science takes many forms with respect to the three essentials I have named above, and is not limited to any one procedure or approach. James Bryant Conant of Harvard stressed the importance of theory in science. But theory is not a defining characteristic of science. Everybody has theories. We have conspiracy theories. Religious mythology is theory. But the defining characteristic of science is the system of observation and proof that backs up the theory. The unscientific methods are all those arguments that are not scientific. And if they pose as science, they are what I call dirty science. I don't want to try to describe all the unscientific arguments because they are potentially infinite in number. I think that most college undergraduates are taught critical thinking, where they learn the difference between legitimate and illegitimate arguments, starting with smear tactics and the classical straw man, ad hominem, and red herring arguments. I define smear words as derogatory words or phrases without any supporting argument. Straw man means representing the opponent's argument as weaker than it actually is, so that it is easier to knock it down. Ad hominem means calling attention to the flaws in a person, real or imagined, rather than the person's argument. Red herring means to create a diversion from the historical practice of dragging smoked herring across a person's trail to distract the bloodhounds from the scent. And the list goes on from there. Instead of trying to identify all the items on an infinite list, I'm going to cover only some of the methods that scientists are likely to use and then point out, as I go along, for each unscientific opinion that I discuss, why it is not scientific. I actually saw and smelled a real red herring, or more accurately, a bait box full of bright pink herring, the summer I was 17. The smell was overwhelming. It helped me understand what I had not learned so well in the classroom, that creating a stink could be a major diversion. And it is helping me to remember now that I had begun learning about illegitimate arguments in my prep school English long before I entered college. This education was contained in Harvard freshman English, which was devoted largely to learning the difference between illegitimate and legitimate arguments. And social sciences one, Snarling Charlie Charrington, used to entertain us with mock propaganda, liberally seasoned with smear words, as a spoof of the kind of thing that Fox News does today. The people I worked with in the computer field, I assumed, had all taken the same or equivalent courses because illegitimate arguments were rarely used, and when they were used, management recognized them as such. But it seems in the scientific community that once people earn their PhDs, they receive some kind of diplomatic immunity from being held to account for illegitimate arguments. And they are free to call anybody loony or fruitcake or crackpot. Actually, the way this works is that they are highly accurate within their fields of expertise, and outside their fields of expertise, who cares? They are not held to account by their peers, who are largely in agreement with them anyway. So it is up to us, common people, to see, first of all, when scientists are offering opinions in areas where they are not qualified, and second, when they are using unscientific arguments. The methods of status are the most common unscientific methods that scientists use. Status is what our parents had when we were small children, and our parents were as gods to us, all-knowing and all-powerful. Status was what our teachers had when their word was truth, and our place was only to memorize. Status is what the clergy has, preaching the word of God. We have all been conditioned in childhood to accept the authority of persons of status, not only to tell us what to do, but also to tell us what to believe. Persons of high status are the nobility, who say to the common person, "We are your betters." Status creates a caste system, separating people judged to be superior from those judged to be inferior. As science has achieved this kind of status, scientists are believed simply on their authority. and any need for evidence is simply swept away. The scientific establishment simply becomes them, an all-knowing source of truth, and anybody so foolish as to disagree with what they say can be ridiculed and declared mentally incompetent. Given this mental atmosphere, first, the cultural conditioning that we have all had, and second, the aura of omniscience that science has acquired, scientists can get away with making authoritarian pronouncements, not supported by scientific studies, expecting to be believed on the basis of their scientific credentials alone, and actually being believed on that basis, but without solid scientific evidence to back them up. Such assertions are simply a bluff. Scientists are simply gambling that you wouldn't want to bet against their enormous status and credentials. The most obvious bluffs are the statements of the form, there are no such things, UFOs, Bigfoot, spirit entities. In order to make such a statement scientifically, one would need to have a complete knowledge of the entire universe. The most extreme example of the authoritarian pronouncement is the scientist proclaiming, "You didn't see what you saw." Usually regarding UFO sightings and alien encounters. First of all, the scientist wasn't there and could not have witnessed the non-event. Second, the scientist, unless telepathic, doesn't know what the person actually saw. And yet scientists actually get away with this stuff and convince a credulous public that the scientist's mind is so superior to that of the non-scientist that the scientist actually knows better what the person actually experienced and that the person may actually have a mental problem. Ridicule takes the bluff one step further, asserting that you are a fool for not knowing this truth, which is obvious to all scientists. We need to call their bluff. We need to ask to see the scientific evidence. I am counting on people who can think for themselves to see that the methods of science and not the credentials of scientists have given us accurate cultural knowledge. And where scientists are trying to use their credentials to give credibility to unscientific methods, I'm counting on you to call their bluff. Refusal by scientists to look at the data is an extreme bias. When scientists refuse to look at the data, they cease to be scientists and become parental figures asserting their superior status. We need to remind them that by doing this, they have disqualified themselves as scientists. We need to throw the word qualified back in their faces to remind them that they who consider themselves qualified are actually not qualified. Another source of extreme bias is the insistence that any physical explanation of a phenomenon is preferable to any non-physical explanation. Be aware that as part of the bluff, scientists may cite the names of studies that don't exist or that don't apply. In this era of the internet and smartphones, it should be easy to check them out. Hard ridicule is more than just a bluff. Hard ridicule is persons in positions of power threatening the livelihood and social existence of those people they are able to dominate. This has nothing to do with science. These are the methods of status, methods of social manipulation and domination, which have existed since the strongman ruled the primitive tribe with a club, and before that, in the hierarchical pecking orders that exist in animal species. These methods of social manipulation and domination are more powerful than the methods of science. One is not likely even to express an interest in parapsychology, knowing that it could be career-ending. These social pressures, unless actively resisted, tend to take over, creating a bias, which diminishes the accuracy of science. Persons of status in the scientific community need to actively oppose the methods of status to make sure that scientific accuracy is not compromised by social pressures. Lawyers who use illegal methods are disbarred. Similarly, scientists who use unscientific methods should lose their credentials. In any event, as an informed public becomes aware of what these scientists are doing, they will lose their credibility. Historically, persons of status have dominated by physical coercion. Scientists, because they are more intelligent and better educated than most of us, are more likely to dominate in a mental way, with what I call mental warfare, mental combat, and mental bullying. By warfare, I mean destructive actions against other people through lies, deceit, and insinuations, as in politics, as opposed to simply presenting the scientific evidence with accurate logic. Mental warfare includes all smear tactics. It includes what I call social pecking, or the kind of social derision used to work on people's emotions, to manipulate them into conforming to group norms. Mental warfare actually can kill people, as when it causes teenagers to commit suicide because of social humiliation. It includes the kind of false and damaging statements that are defined legally as defamation, but it is not limited to any legal definition or even to things that people actually say. Mental warfare has been characterized vividly as shark attacks by Larry Berg in his book Let Magic Happen. This comes from a paper presented by Richard J. Johns, allegedly translated from a paper in French by Voltaire Cousteau, who died in 1812. This clever spoof claims to have been written for sponge divers, but is really aimed at the academic world. The object of shark attacks is not to establish any scientific truth, but simply to rip apart any non-conforming argument by any means. I have observed that some people with powerful mentalities are actually able to block my thought process while I am in their force field. I call this mind jamming and mind scrambling. We need to be aware that this is a possibility when we are going head to head with the powerful minds of scientists. Shark attacks probably incorporate this ability, plus any other tricks that a powerful mind can produce. Members of the scientific establishment will ridicule the idea of a mental force field at the same time as they are using it. Warfare wins wars, but warfare does not create accurate knowledge. In smear attacks, there is a speaker, a target, and an audience. The speaker says derogatory things about the target to be believed by the audience. This involves some mental phenomenon related to hypnosis to implant the suggestion in the minds of the audience that the smear actually applies to the target. The attention of the audience is focused on the target. The attention of the audience should instead be focused on the speaker as the person creating the smear, and as the kind of person who creates smear tactics. Richard Milton, author of Shattering the Myths of Darwinism, successfully turns this around when he points the finger at critic Richard Dawkins. Quote, according to a review by Darwinist Richard Dawkins, Milton's book is loony, stupid, drivel, and its author a harmless fruitcake who needs psychiatric help. When I read this, I asked myself, don't they have laws against defamation in England? Thus, I was prompted to take a trip to the Duke University libraries to find out what Dawkins really said. Locating the review required a great deal of help from the librarians, because The New Statesman from 1992, which Milton cited, went bankrupt and did not exist in 1992. Instead, we found the review in something called The New Statesman and Society. It was on microfilm and barely legible, but worth finding, because it showed how Dawkins was clever enough to do his defamation without actually saying that Milton was all those things. Dawkins starts off by saying, quote, "Every day I get letters in capitals and obsessively underlined, if not actually in green ink, from flat earthers, young earthers, perpetual motion merchants, astrologers, and other harmless fruitcakes. The only difference here is that Richard Milton has managed to get his stuff published." In a very roundabout way, by criticizing Milton's publisher, Dawkins manages to convey to the reader that Milton belongs in the category of people he calls harmless fruitcakes. As for needs psychiatric help, he quotes Francis Crick as saying, "Anyone who believes that the earth is less than 10,000 years old needs psychiatric help," thereby avoiding again direct defamation of Milton. Actually, Milton is questioning the dating methods used by scientists and the accuracy of the thought process upon which those methods are based. Dawkins ignores that whole argument instead, saying, "Perhaps the world really did bounce into existence in 6006 BC, implanting the idea in our heads that Milton is using the fundamentalist argument without actually saying that he does. So we really can't call Dawkins guilty of misrepresentation here either. He spices up the review with a generous collection of smear words, starting with the title "Fossil Fool," followed by "obsessively," "fruitcakes," "silly," "fabrication," "unqualified hack," "fairies," "werewolves," "loony," "wretched publisher," "egregious howlers," "twaddle," "complete and total ignorance," "nonsense," "stupid," and "silly season drivel." Without successfully applying these descriptions to Milton or his book, but just firing off these shots to enhance the flavor of the review. This is the first of many lists of smear words that I will offer in order to identify the poison in what some people are saying. I offer it as an exercise for students of critical thinking to go through a piece of writing and pick out and underline the obvious smear words, such as silly, moronic, and idiotic, and then ask whether the whole piece of writing isn't just a setting for these gems and their intended purpose of manipulating people emotionally. Dawkins is particularly expert at this kind of manipulation. And Milton does a good job of turning things around, pointing out the unscientific nature of the criticism by saying, "This is not the language of a responsible scientist and teacher." Actually, Dawkins is so manipulative in this review that I don't even believe his biology. Milton, the target, has pointed the finger back at Dawkins, the speaker, to show that Dawkins' unscientific language more accurately represents Dawkins and not Milton. Milton then goes on to say that Dawkins also attacked his publisher for being so irresponsible as to publish a book criticizing Darwinism. This can be turned around too. The New Statesman, which advertises the intelligence, range, and quality of its writing, escapes because of its temporary condition of bankruptcy. But its placeholder, the New Statesman in Society, can certainly be criticized for publishing anything as irresponsible and unscientific as Dawkins' review. The speaker accusing the target of doing something that the speaker is actually doing is psychological projection. It serves the double purpose of directing attention away from what the speaker is doing, at the same time that it is smearing the target. This is done all the time in politics. I remember once in New Hampshire receiving Republican junk mail warning me of Democratic dirty tricks. The Democrat, Katrina Swett, conducted a pristine campaign, while the Republican, Charlie Bass, waged his usual dirty campaign. Hypnosis is ridiculed by the scientific establishment, and yet something related to hypnosis is used all the time in our daily lives. Every time anybody makes a statement, that statement is first implanted in our minds and memories, as in a recording, before we are able to examine it critically. If we do not examine it critically, it becomes part of our belief system. Even if we do examine it critically and reject it, it remains recorded in our memories, conscious or subconscious, forever. When the speaker makes a statement about the target, it is implanted in our minds as a representation of the target. It is necessary to be aware of this consciously and recognize that every statement is a reflection of the speaker and not the target. If the speaker uses smear tactics, it should be recognized that the speaker is the kind of person who uses smear tactics, and the speaker should lose credibility as a result. Another ingredient of shark attacks is what I call preemptive misrepresentation. Whatever you don't say can and will be used against you. If you haven't told these people your whole life story, they can jump in with some quick fiction to discredit you in some area that you haven't covered. For example, they might call me a believer because I haven't yet said where I stand on the subject of religion. And they probably have already dismissed the dream of my grandmother's death with some quick fiction to secure their belief that such things are impossible. Watch out for implied premises. If you let them use the word supernatural, they have half won the argument already, because it implies that what is natural has already been defined, and they know what it is. Also, the word skeptic is used to convey the false premise that a person is open-minded, when actually these people are zealots whose minds are totally closed to anything beyond establishment views. They are more appropriately known as pseudo-skeptics. They will sit there with a smile on their face and find everything you are saying totally amusing. The shark attack experienced by Larry Burke started out with the gambit: this course needs to be taught by a skeptic. Immediately, the false premise has been inserted into the discussion, and then, without allowing time to determine what is meant by skeptic, or whether the course should be appropriately taught by such a person, the quick fiction continues with, "Dr. Burke, do you consider yourself a skeptic?" Faced with this interrogation, Burke says he felt like the proverbial deer in the headlights. Other examples of unscientific methods I will give as I go along as they apply. Politicians can use invalid arguments, dirty tricks, attack ads, and opponent bashing in order to win votes. But scientists can be held to a standard, the scientific method. If they are using unscientific methods, it is not necessary to defeat them in warfare. It is necessary only to point out that they are not doing science and are losing credibility as a result.